the glories of the Holy Name and the exclusive position of Krishna's name above all other aspects of spiritual practice. Also, its focus on this age of Kali as being the essence of all spiritual practices and the designated means for self-realization by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, or actually the Supreme Lord himself, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the second class, we spoke about the nine keys. We didn't even go into all nine, but at least we got through seven. Keys for techniques for chanting, for improved chanting based on the Shikshastikam prayers. And then we'll just go through a little summary on these nine keys. And then what I'll do is I'll add a little something, and that is the anarthas. Because it's all about removing anarthas. The soul is pure, and the soul can never be what we say impure. It's always pure. But the soul gets covered by the material energy. And although the sun is still in the sky, the clouds cover the sun. But the sun is never affected by the clouds. Similarly, the soul is never affected by material energy, but it just appears to be. And what is that appearance? Due to one's misidentification with oneself, thinking oneself the body. And therefore, because of that, these clouds come, and these are all called illusions or misconceptions. So spiritual practice means to destroy, remove the clouds, and bring out the pure soul again. That's all back to its realized nature. We realize we're the soul, not just theoretically. And what covers them? They're called anarthas. There's 16 anarthas, four categories of form. We'll just mention them. And what are the four anarthas in the four categories? Philosophical misconceptions, attachments to pious attachments to the benefits of pious activities, attachments to the benefits, not benefits, but attachments to impious activities, that is, sinful activities. And the last one is offenses, four categories of four. So, what are the four philosophical misconceptions? These, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, these are the easiest to get rid of. Or at least according to the process of bhakti, they're removed on earlier stages of practice. The other ones are removed on higher stages. What are the four philosophical misconceptions? First one is to not understand your identity, thinking yourself something other than a spirit soul or Krishna's part and parcel. So the philosophy that supports that concept and that understanding, we should know that. That's all. It's not talking about realized knowledge, it's talking about the philosophical principles that govern the understanding of who we are. First one. I'm just going to go through. You can stop me at any time if you'd like to expand on whatever one I go on. Second one is Krishna. Who's Krishna? What is his identity? Well, we know he's God, but that's not enough. We know we have to know him as God, as Krishna, not just God. That is the personality of Godhead as a person who has qualities, activities, forms, so many things related to him, his entourage, everything, his dham. So some understanding of Krishna, some. When somebody says, who's Krishna? Well, he's God. That's not enough. It's true, he is God. But we have to know a little bit more about what is the nature of that Supreme Personality. So that's the second one. The third philosophical misconception is not understanding the principles that govern sadhana and prema bhakti. How bhakti works. Bhakti is a science. The science is explained in Nectar of Devotion. Srila Prabhupada emphasizes, please read Nectar of Devotion. He said, don't read it. He said, read it once, read it twice, read it thrice. There's one lecture, he said. He says, you must at least get an understanding of this, because it's the handbook for practicing bhakti. Just like if you buy a computer, they give you all these, you know, or a cell phone or whatever kind of gadgets they sell nowadays. They give you these, you know, tons of material on how it all works. And you'd usually go crazy trying to read it all. But at least you get some basic understanding how to operate the machine, and you can go ahead and do things. So bhakti is a science, and that science is explained nicely by Srila Rupa Goswami, who received his knowledge from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu directly at Dasama Medaka in 10 days of discourse, where the Lord just spoke the whole science of bhakti to Srila Rupa Goswami, very, very scientific. Rupa Goswami wrote it all down later in the form of two works, Bhakti Rasamrita Sundar mostly, and Ujjwala Nilamani, of course also Nectar of Instructions, Upadeshamrita. So the science is there, how bhakti works. If you do something, you get a certain result. There's things to do, things to avoid. Alas, and then that same science applied to higher principles of bhakti, and that is, how does prema bhakti work? What is the science? If you simply read Jiva Dharma, you can just get an understanding. And Srila Prabhupada said, all devotees in this ISKCON movement must read this book, Jiva Dharma. That's there. He said, this book is one of the most important books. He says, the whole science of bhakti, if you just read that one book, it's all there. From the sadhana bhakti, it is very, how we say, infinite understanding, all the way up to the highest form of bhakti and how it works, and all the intricacies, yes.
Even before one has read through Srila Prabhupada's books?
Well, he didn't give us an order, but he did say at one point, he said you should read my books. Definitely, he said. We're referring to, you know, four books, he said. Nectar of Devotion, Sri Upanishads, Nectar of Devotion, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srimad Bhagavatam, these four books. At that time when he said it, there wasn't the full Bhagavatam out. He gave his Krishna book. At the time that he said it, the Chaitanya Charitamrita wasn't out. He just had teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So when he said four books, there was actually four books that time. Now we have volumes that make up one, what we say, set of books. But that was Prabhupada's instructions. There's actually a lecture, it's called Four Books. So these are the essence. But I think what Prabhupada wanted us to do, to attend Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam classes daily, come to the classes. He said, by coming to these classes, you'll learn Gita, you'll learn Srimad Bhagavatam. And then he also had Nectar of Devotion classes, too. And then there used to be Krishna book readings also. Right? Is that correct, Bhajri? Used to read Krishna book every day?
He used to, yes. And Prabhupada even actually started Nectar of Devotion classes instead of Bhagavatam class in L.A. for some time. And Isha Upanishad also.
Yeah, there's weeks of classes on Nectar of Devotion, several classes. So these... This is the basic of all philosophical teachings in those four books. But he did mention that we should read these two. He actually said you should read all of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books. But he emphasized two books, Chaitanya Shikshamrita and Jiva Dharma. And there's one statement in this regard. So. But you can get the whole science in Nectar of Devotion. That's fine. That's there. So I'm not emphasizing Jiva Dharma over Nectar Devotion. I'm saying if you want to go really into the depth of the essence of Prema Bhakti, it's all there. So those, okay, and the last philosophical misconception is not understanding not having a complete understanding of the difference between bhakti and other philosophical teachings, like mixing in other things with bhakti, such as mayavad. So these are the four philosophical misconceptions. The four anarthas by pious activities is desire for material sense gratification, material happiness. In other words, to enjoy the material world, some material happiness. Second one is aspiration to Swargaloka. Want to go to heaven. And we want to bring heaven on earth, but we can't, so we'll go to, let's go to heaven anyway. I mean, you read about it in Bhagavatam, what's the heavenly planets, long life compared to this. This life is like an insect life compared to the life on heavenly planets. People have good, healthy bodies, they live long, they're beautiful, they're qualified, there's hardly any disease. Everything is, we say, materially ideal. So to aspire for such things, that's an anartha. The third one is to desire to develop mystic power. When you perform bhakti, you can also get power. You get power. And if you can also use that power. But if the goal is to get power, or some kind of mystical power, through the process of bhakti, that's an anartha. Or to have that desire. Like that. And the last one is liberation. To aspire for, I think it's Sahuja Mukti, not the, what we say, the liberation such as Sharshti, Samipya, Salokya, and Sarupya. Those are not considered anarthas, but still a devotee one doesn't want them anyway. That's why we chant every day, Nadananda Janamna Sundaram Kavitam Vajagadisha Kamaye Manma Janmani Janmani Ishvari Bhavatat Bhakti Ahoyitiki. Janmani, Janmani Ishvare. I don't want wealth, I don't want followers, I don't want the pleasures of the opposite sex. I don't even want to be known as a great scholar of the Vedas. Bhaktivinoda Thakur adds that to that verse. To be known as a literary carrier of great knowledge. That's another form of what we say false pride. And what do I want? I want devotional service, not just this life, but I'm willing to come back life after life, simply if I can engage in pure devotional service. So that's, devotee doesn't aspire for anything but devotional service. Because devotional service is so satisfying that everything else is insignificant. That's the point. If you're hungry, you'll eat anything. I mean, not anything, but anything that is edible. If you're starving, someone brings something edible, you eat it because you want to satisfy. But if you have a choice, you'll take what you like. You'll take the best. So in that way, when we haven't tasted the higher taste of bhakti, we think these other things are, what we say, relishable or desirable. But as soon as we taste the sweetness of bhakti, it's Prabodhananda Saraswati says. He says, aspiring for higher planets is like, he calls it Akash Pushpayate. That means flowers in the sky. Flowers don't grow in the sky. But if you think flowers grow in the sky, then that's an illusion. So for a devotee, the glories of the heavenly planets are just like illusions. In other words, they have no meaning in the devotee's life. And liberation, he calls it niraki, hell. He says, it's hell compared to bhakti. And he glorifies Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in that same verse as being, you know, just to get the opportunity to serve Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's complete satisfaction. So that's the four pious activities. For pious anarthas, the four impious is trying to enjoy things that cannot be used in devotional service. In other words, we might say the four regulative principles, you know, breaking the principles like that. These types of enjoyment. And the second one is deceit and fault finding. Finding fault and being deceitful. Devotee is simple. What you see is what you get. That's what devotee is. Deceit, fault finding, we can go in that. And then the third one is envy. Prabhupada said envy is what brings us to the material world. Envy is what keeps us in the material world. So that envy starts with being envious of Krishna, and then it comes out in different forms in this world. And then the last one is the desire for pratishtha, or to be famous, to be known. These are the four impious anarthas. And the four offenses to the Lord in the form of the deity, offenses to the holy name, offenses to Vaishnavas, offenses to people in general. Even if you're a Vaishnava, you can't offend anyone, not even the non-devotees. You think, oh, they're just rotten carnies. No. They're also spirit souls too. So, these are the four. Now, out of the anarthas, the ones that stay with the devotee the longest is the offenses. It's easy to commit offenses. It's hard to free yourself from the reactions of offenses. The other ones get removed on the lower stages of bhakti. Knowing the nine stages, adhastrata, sarasanga, bhajana, kriya, anarthi, nivritti, nishta, ruchi, ashakti, bhava, and prema, the nine stages. On bhajana, kriya, the philosophical misconceptions can be destroyed. On ruchi, the pious and impious activities can be destroyed. But offenses carry all the way up to prema. Even if you have prema, you can commit an offense. It says, only when you see Krishna face to face, then there's no question of offenses anymore. That means a higher stage of prema. So the offense is a little difficult. So what's the solution? If these 16 anarthas cause the six enemies. What are the six enemies? Lust, anger, greed, illusion, pride, and envy. These six produce birth. I'm sorry, no, it isn't. Hunger and thirst, lamentation and illusion, disease and death. Or old age and death. One of those two, I can't remember. Or birth and death. It's one of those last two. And those six, they call them whips or waves, they can only be destroyed by Hari Nam Sankirtan. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the process of bhakti can destroy the anarthas, but what crushes the anarthas fast is kirtan. Fast. So chanting of the holy names actually removes the effects of anarthas very, very quickly. When that kirtan is done in glorification of the Lord. So this is the process. So that's why we decided to have this weekend to understand that there's no more powerful process of purification than chanting Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna. Hare Hare. Hare Rama. Hare Rama. Rama Rama.
So you want to help us come to a deeper understanding of the glories of the holy name, the position of the holy name in relationship to everything else, and how that holy name actually basically is really the essence of all practice. But as we mentioned yesterday, we have to do other practices in order to purify our hearts so we can chant. But when you actually come to the stage of chanting the holy names, that's all you need. There's nothing else required. But to come to that stage means to come to the mode of goodness. Coming to the mode of goodness, therefore, we need deity worship, and we need the process of bhakti as given by the acharyas. But ultimately, we want to come to remembering Krishna always by chanting his holy name. That's the goal. The goal is to remember Krishna always. Okay, any questions? Comments? Mataji?
I have a question about offenses. How are we to be aware that we are committing offenses? I mean, we could be going on and not even realize offenses are being committed in the strong spiritual.
Well, there's Nectar of Devotion explains the offenses. Madhuri Kandambini explains the offenses in greater detail. Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions the offenses in his different writings. But within each of the categories, like, for instance, offenses to the deity, that's mentioned in Nectar of Devotion, in the 8th chapter. Those you can... If you carefully follow the regulative principles, then you pretty much can easily avoid offenses. But then there's a mood of devotion that is required in order to keep us free from committing offenses. And what is that mood? Aham, humility, tolerance, pridelessness, and respect for others. That cultivating these qualities frees us from the tendency to commit offenses. Now, even if we make a mistake unknowingly, there is a little offense. Just like Prabhupada was, if you sit like this in front of the deities, that's an offense. You can't sit like that. Sorry to use your example, but anyway. It just happened to appear that way. You can't cross your legs in front of the deities, or you can't lie down in front of the deities, you can't talk to people in front of the deities, other than, something that's Krishna conscious. In other words, you can't have your conversations in front of the deities. You can't, what is it?
You can't chastise anyone, I think.
You can't chastise in front of the deities. You can't cry in front of the deities. You can't get angry in front of the deities. These are all offenses. So that's mentioned in Nectar of Devotion. So a lot of times people don't know that. But as soon as you know it, then you stop it. That's all. That's how you avoid it. That's why deity worship offenses are not just for the pujari. It's for everyone who comes into the temple. Now, guests are not... Anyone who comes in as a guest is not going to get a reaction for offenses. Because guests don't know. They just don't know the etiquette, the behavior, so that's different. But for those who are living in the temple and practicing the science of bhakti, they have to be aware of that. And therefore, as soon as you have the opportunity for the knowledge, you become responsible for what you do. But guests are not responsible. But if they know it, they should avoid it also. Okay? Now, sometimes we see Vaishnavas when they say, please forgive my offenses, knowingly or unknowingly, sometimes we commit an offense. I'll give you an example how subtle offenses are. There's two examples I can think of. One of them was, I mean, there's many. Sachi Mata, Lord Chaitanya's mother, the supreme, goddess, she's like pure of the pure. She was a little upset with Advaita Acharya, because Advaita Acharya was teaching her first son, Vishwaroop, all about bhakti. And Vishwaroop was learning a lot, and he was going there regularly. And because of his association with Advaita Acharya, he decided not to get married, give up everything, and take sannyas. And then he left home, never to be seen again. So now Nimai, her other son, was also associated with the Dvaita Acharya. So she's thinking, oh no, he's doing it again. He's going to take my other son away. So this Advaita Acharya, he's not Advaita, non-dual. He's Dvaita. He's dualistic. He's duplicious. She didn't say it. She just thought it. So when Lord Chaitanya was performing the 21-hour Mahaprakash Lila, he was giving out his blessings and benefits to all the devotees. And he was asking each and every devotee, please take a blessing. Whatever you ask, I'll give you. So devotees were saying, please give my father pure love of God. Please give me to serve you life after life. You know, nobody was asking for anything material. So someone said, please give Mother Sachi pure love of God. Said that to Lord Chaitanya became silent. He said, my mother, she's an offender. She can't get love of God. Everyone was shocked. They couldn't believe it, what he was saying. And then he explained. And then Sachi was there. She was listening. And Dvaita Acharya was also there. So he said, Lord Chaitanya said, the only way she can get love of God is she takes the dust of the lotus feet of a Dvaita Acharya and puts it on her head. That's the only way. Now, Dvaita Acharya wasn't going to let that happen. Put his foot in his foot dust on Mother Sachi's head. But therefore, what could Sachi do? So then there was a roaring kirtan after, and the Dvaita Acharya fainted in ecstasy. And Lord Chaitanya looked at his mother and gave her the signal. And she took the dust. Now, actually, Sachi Mata did not commit any offense. But Lord Chaitanya was using this example to show how subtle offenses can be. So, therefore, if you think wrongly of something, or you think negatively, you don't get a reaction in this age. In previous ages you did. In the Bhagavatam, the 18th chapter of the first canto, I think it's verse number 7, it explains that because of the Kali Yuga being so bad, you're not responsible for negative thoughts. In previous ages, people were responsible for negative thoughts. But you get benefits for positive thoughts. But the problem with negative thoughts is that it can lead to something. And as soon as they lead to either speech or action, then there's the offense. So that's what Lord Chaitanya was trying to bring out. Our mind should be free from all forms of negativity. Like that. Rupa Goswami was in meditation. And he was meditating on a humorous pastime of Radha and Krishna. And then there was an ugly sage walking by. And Rupa Goswami, as soon as that ugly sage was passing by, he started to laugh, not at the sage, but by seeing this humorous pastime of Radha Krishna in his own mind. And then the sage was thinking, Rupa Goswami is a great sadhu, why is he laughing at me? And he became a little unhappy and left, and just kept walking. Rupa Goswami's meditation broke, and then he went trying to go back into meditation, he couldn't. And then later he told Sanatana Goswami the situation. I was meditating, I couldn't go back. Did I commit some offense or something like that? And then Sanatana Goswami started to ask him some questions. And then he remembered, oh yes, there was this sage that walked by. He said, yes, maybe you offended him by laughing. So you should make some rectification. One of my god sisters, very senior god sister, she said one day she was chanting japa and was going out and then she wasn't getting any taste from her japa. And she said, I was thinking maybe I committed an offense that I don't remember. So she prayed, my dear Lord, if I've committed some offense, help me to understand it so I can rectify it. So the next day, she told me this personally. She actually said it in the class. She said, I got a phone call from a friend who said, you know, you offended this other lady's child, and she's very angry about you, what you did to her child. So you should apologize. So she did. And she said right after that, her japa became good or nice again. So sometimes we don't know, so you can pray, my dear Lord, if I made some offense to somebody, if I did something wrong, please forgive me, and please understand how I can get over it. If you're humble, that's the point. If you're humble, even if you've committed a big mistake, you can be forgiven. But if you're proud, even if you commit a small mistake, you can't be forgiven. So that's the point. And sometimes we do make mistakes or commit offenses unknowingly. Like that.
The offenses to the Vaishnavas, we know that they count, but we are told that if they are not Vaishnavas, then should we go ahead and make offenses to non-Vaishnavas, thinking if they are not going to count?
No, that's one of the four categories, offenses to people in general. You can offend the persons who are not Vaishnavas or non-devotees, people in general. Now, that means if you're actually offensive, people may take offense, and when you're not offensive, that's something different. But if you're actually offensive, yeah. And if you fail to respect people, we should respect everyone accordingly. Yeah. And Prabhupada said, what is a devotee? A devotee is a perfect gentleman. That's all. A devotee is gentle. He's not, what we say, too transcendental. Ranaswami says, he says, you become so transcendental you forget to be nice. Yeah, devotees have their different moods, but we should give regards to others. That's all. Devotee is by nature friendly. Or at least, he's not insensitive to other people. If you are, how can you preach? How can you preach if you're insensitive? And sometimes we make mistakes just because of the way we do things. But therefore we just pray for forgiveness and so on. Now, if you can go, if you don't know what offenses you've made, you can go to one island in the Navadvip area called Koladvip and go to the ashram of Devananda Pandit. And go there and take darshan there and offer some prayers. And it says all your offenses. All Vaishnava offenses are destroyed. That's one place you can get your Vaishnava offenses. But it's not like you just make a regular trip there and then go back. It's not like, like going to church and going to confession on Saturday, And the whole week I just do all my nonsense. My dear priest, I did this. Okay, 6 Hail Marys, 24 Our Fathers, and, we'll bless you, and you can go out and do it again. Prabhupada never liked that. He was very strong about this idea. He said, all right, you make a mistake. You're sorry, you get some penance. And then you go out and you do it again. All right. So maybe the second time you can be forgiven. But if you keep doing it, then that's the problem.
The fifth kind of explains that as Kunjar Shojum. Bath of an elephant's bath.
What's that?
The elephant's bath.
Elephant's bath.
Yes. Hastisthan.
Yeah. Punjab Shoshan.
Yeah.
Maharaj, I was in a darshan. Prabhupada said, I'll forgive you once, I'll forgive you twice. Third time I take off my shoe.
Yeah. 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 This is something about the number three. If you want to emphasize something good, do it three times. And if you do something negative three times, that's an emphasis also. Therefore, you get a reaction like that. That's where we say Harinam, 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 Eva Kevalam, Kalala Nasteva, Nasteva, Nasteva. There's no other way, no other way, no other way than chanting Hare Krishna, chanting Hare Krishna, chanting the holy names. Three times for emphasis. Yes?
Kali Yuga seems like it's very challenging because it's hard. Kali Yuga is very challenging.
Not very. It's extremely challenging.
You know, sometimes you hear, especially with outsiders, devotees from outside of ISKCON, they always criticize us. Honestly, it's hard to don't be angry in one point.
Yeah. Yeah. Anger is destroyed by forgiveness. Anger is the younger brother of desire. When desire is unfulfilled or frustrated, one becomes angry or unhappy or upset. And if somebody does something, you become angry, you can just forgive, that's all. And how can you forgive? Because you expect the same thing when you do something to someone else, that they'll forgive you. So why not forgive someone else? If you can't forgive someone else for what they did to you, how do you expect others to forgive you for what you did to them? So you look at it from that point. Then it becomes a lot easier to understand that forgiveness is the way to go. It's like I was preaching in London, and there was one lady, she came to me. I gave a whole class on this Vaishnava relationships. She came up to me and said, "You know, Maharaj, I'm holding this grudge against this one person for 25 years. I can't get over it. It's just so strong." She said, "I heard your class, everything you said makes sense, but I still can't give it up." So I said, "It's not for their benefit you're giving it up. It's for your benefit you're giving it up. Carrying that thing is like carrying a big weight, that's all. If you hold a grudge against someone, you are the one that suffers more than the person who is directed upon."
There's a saying I read somewhere that holding a grudge is like drinking poison and hoping the other person would die.
Yeah. Holding a grudge is like drinking poison and hoping the other person will die.
Wow.
That's what he said. Yeah, you're the one. Negativity only hurts the person who carries it, more than the person that it was directed on. So forgive, that's all. It's not so easy sometimes. Sometimes it takes a while to come to that. But even if it takes a while, that should be the goal. It may not happen immediately.